Hey, it's me, Lars Larson. Thanks for checking out my podcast, and be sure to tell a friend about the Lars Larson Show.
Happy Tuesday, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. It is a pleasure to be with you all over the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho as we attempt to deliver honestly provocative talk radio for Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Glad to be with you, and we got a lot to talk about today, starting with our Twitter poll. And I want to ask you this. This is not just a rhetorical question. You are already paying the bill. If somebody said to you, have you thought about buying an electric car? Yeah, maybe. They don't really fit my needs. I understand. That describes more than 99% of car owners in America. It certainly describes more than 99% of all car owners in the Pacific Northwest. So you might wonder, why are you asking me about paying for electric car chargers, Lars? And the answer is because you are by law. You have been all of this month through your electric bill. And if you wonder, well, how did that happen? The Oregon legislature passed House Bill 2165. I'm sure that Jay Inslee has something similar in mind for Washington State, but maybe not yet. It requires the utilities, all of the utilities, to collect a monthly charge beginning January 1, so now that's 24 days ago, for transportation electrification infrastructure, a fancy way of saying car chargers. They're going to spend the money. Well, part of it, they're going to spend on what they call underserved communities, which means the Oregon legislature can do a little bit of virtue signaling on your dime by saying, well, we're going to spend part of this on poorer people. But as we know already, poorer people, for the most part, are not buying electric cars. You know who buys electric cars for the most part? That would be wealthy people. And why? Because the same car powered by electricity right now, even with subsidies, even with all the assistance, even with free car charging, still costs a lot more than a comparable gasoline or diesel car, which is why it really doesn't make much sense unless you're a wealthy person who says, hey, I'm gonna buy an electric car. They say, is that going to be your daily commuter? Oh, no, I'll drive it when I want to signal virtue to all my greenie friends. But most of the time, I'm going to drive the car that's sensible, the one I can gas up in about 7 minutes. Everybody will pay to support, as Oregon Catalyst points out, everybody will pay to support the 1% who can afford to register an electric vehicle in the state of Oregon. Some of the money will be spent on underserved communities, but the reality is, as they say, most electric vehicle owners are wealthy people. So, our question on the Twitter poll, should all electric customers pay to fund car chargers for a tiny, wealthy minority of owners? My answer to that would be no. I imagine I may get a naysayer or two today, and I'm sure to get at least one person who says, well, I only make average wages, but I decided to buy an electric car. And it'd be interesting to talk to that naysayer about why they made that choice. I mean, most of the time when you have something you need, whether it's clothing or transportation or food or whatever, people make sensible choices. They decide that unless they have a gigantic bank account, they don't spend more for something than they absolutely have to. So this is the Oregon legislature, your representatives, who've decided for that wealthy minority, everybody who pays an electric bill in the state pays. So I guess that doesn't include the people camped out in the tents on the side of the freeway or living in the shanties where the heroin is sold on a regular basis. No, it only includes those of you who get that electric bill in the winter and go, wow, and you walk right over to the thermostat and turn down the heat. Or you start running around like my dad used to, turning out lights, saying, who left this light on in a room when nobody's in there? Yeah, you're going to pay more so that wealthy people can drive electric cars and show everybody how special they are. In any case, that's our Twitter poll, found at Lars Larson Show, if you can tolerate Twitter. If you don't like Twitter, go to my website. That's LarsLarson.com. And it's always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers always go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. If you'd rather email, talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you, of course, you can check out our Facebook page. On Getter, we're at Lars Larson, and on Twitter, at Lars Larson Show. I've started to notice a trend. And let me line it out for you this way. Oregon made it legal to get a high school diploma without being able to read, write, or do math. Now, that was a bill called 744. And I've had some critics say, Lars, that bill didn't say you didn't have to be able to read, write, or do math. It just said you didn't have to prove it by taking a test to show that you could read, write, or do math. And I replied to that person by saying, okay, fine, on that basis, I can throw a football better than Tom Brady. And if you say, well, prove it. I said, no, I don't have to prove it. I just have to assert it. That's what we've said. You can get a high school diploma, at least in the state of Oregon, without being able to prove that you can read, write, or do math. Now, there might be that rare person out there who actually reads better than anybody, writes better than Hemingway, and can do math like Einstein. But if they don't take the test, how are you going to know whether or not they got that education? So Oregon made the no read, no math, no write high school diploma possible. Number two, Oregon made it legal for some to teach in the public schools without having a college degree. So we're lowering our standards there. Oregon also changed the rules last year to say, if you are absent without cause or explanation from school for 10 days, the current rule is you are considered a dropout. But they don't want to count dropouts because Oregon has one of the highest dropout rates in the United States of America. So they said, let's get rid of the rule. You can miss 10 days of school unexplained, no cause, no explanation, and you are still not considered a dropout. And then finally, I'm not at the end of the list of things that are happening that show a trend. Teachers' unions have decided that they no longer have to deliver quality learning, and the paycheck stays the same. Imagine that. You still get paid the same amount of money. It's like that low opinion that some people say who work in minimum wage jobs who say, I get paid the same whether I work fast or slow, whether I finish the job or not. Now, with that kind of attitude, that's not very healthy for your kids. Finally, the actual statistics, and the newest ones came out just a couple of weeks ago. One kid in five drops out of school altogether. Of those that stay, about half of them, sometimes less than half, make the minimum marks on state tests. Now, I pointed this out before. Here's the latest development that I think shows the trend. As the Wall Street Journal reports, put away your number two pencils, the new Scholastic Aptitude Test, the SAT test, the one you take if you're going on to community college or any other kind of education, will be shorter, simpler, and easier. The shift will begin internationally in March of next year in the United States in March of 2024. The PSAT will go digital. The digital SAT will be easier to take, easier to give, and more relevant, they say. The new test, well, the old one took 3 hours. The new one will take about 2 hours. Reading passages will be shorter. Maybe that's to make up for the Oregon graduates. And will be followed by one question. And math problems will be less wordy. And you'll be able to use a calculator on all of it. Boy, does it sound like a country that is in competition with a lot of other very well-educated countries is deciding to dumb down its requirements at the very wrong time in history. In any case, glad to be with you on a Tuesday. If you want to call, it's 866-HEY-LARS. Coming up, Joe Biden, the man who followed Mean Tweets Orange Man into office, calls a reporter for a major network a stupid SOB. My take on the Delawarean who promised decency, coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
During the campaign, Joe Biden ran as that decent guy while Donald Trump was the mean tweeter. Well, on his first day, Biden promised to return decency to the White House. Quote, if you're ever working with me and I hear you treat another with disrespect, I promise you I will fire you on the spot. Oh, what a difference a bad year in office makes. And by the way, if you haven't noticed, Joe's having a bad year. More deaths from COVID than during Trump. Record numbers of illegal aliens across our border. A deadly and humiliating exit from Afghanistan. So when Peter Ducey, yesterday from Fox News, asked a perfectly reasonable question about inflation, President Decency replied into a hot mic that Ducey was a, quote, stupid son of a bitch. To be fair, Biden called Ducey last night and apologized for that. But for all the media types who clutched their pearls and swooned over Donald Trump's criticism of openly hostile news coverage. Joe only holds you in high regard, boys and girls of journalism, if you do not ask hard questions. These days, what's your favorite flavor is about all this confused commander-in-chief can handle. God forbid anybody ask Joe about the millions of dollars that a Ukrainian company paid his son. You know, the same country we're about to send troops to defend. Think of what he'd call you if you asked that question. And this one. Lars, last January, Mr. Disunity, a.k.a. Joe Biden, said if anybody on his staff disrespected anyone, he'd fire them on the spot. And then he calls Peter Ducey a stupid SOB. I know there is no chance of Mr. Disunity firing himself to keep that promise. That would take integrity, something he doesn't have. So the American people will have to fire him instead. He's definitely getting a pink slip from me. And then I'll get to the question of the day a little bit later on. Let's do the Daily Grill so I can get to some callers, including a naysayer. Today's Daily
insane.
Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Today's Daily Grill, I'm going to gladly award to the folks at the Mukilteo School District. And why? The book banner's there. They have now banned a book written by Harper Lee, won the Pulitzer Prize, written in 1960, in the language of the day and about some really terrible things. But it was a book of fiction. It's strange. They've banned the book because they say it's racist. Somebody suggested to me, Lars, didn't Barack Obama call To Kill a Mockingbird his favorite book? And I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, he did. And now it's banned in one Washington State school district because it's a racist book? Does that mean Barack Obama's racist? Or that they're wrong about To Kill a Mockingbird being a racist book? In any case, the grill goes to the Mukilteo School Board or school district. Our best email of the day, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com, is brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest. Now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus online at rivercityusa.com/careers. Michael writes in, Lars, so the governor of New York got slapped by the New York Supreme Court that the governor's mask mandates were not legal or constitutional, as the governor didn't have the power for such an order. It's so sad that Oregon has no non-biased courts to uphold the rule here. Kate gets to do whatever she likes. And now I see on the news that they feel if you fail one of the free home tests, the ones that are not accurate at all, you need to go in and get a real test. Just add yourself to one of the many positives in Oregon so they can keep the infected numbers up and mask mandate forever. Mark my words, we're going to see the infected numbers go up, not down. I was born in Oregon. I've lived here my whole life. If I had enough to move and I could, I would do it. Signed, Michael, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. To your calls, and as always, if there's a naysayer, we start with a naysayer. Corey, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about today?
Hi there. So I don't really per se agree with the whole reading, writing, and all that stuff for high school.
You don't agree with reading and writing and arithmetic for high school? Are you saying you don't think they need to know how?
I'm not the smartest person. You know, I graduated college or high school. I knew like a day before I was graduating. And I think it's kind of to a point. I don't agree with how they're doing it, but I don't think that it needs to be as hyped up as it is per se.
What is hyped up? I mean, and I'm not entirely understanding it, Corey. If you think it's not a bad idea that kids should not have to learn how to read, write, or count to get a high school diploma, what should be the standard for getting a high school diploma? 3 box tops and 75 cents or what?
No, I just don't think it should be set as high as it is.
You think we should lower our standards?
Yeah, I mean, I went to a trade school, college graduate, graduated top of my class in diesel technology. But in order to get into a cheaper school, say like Clark College here in Clark County, you have to meet a certain criteria in order to even get to that that diesel technology, and it's what, like $5,000, I think, a term.
But you have sounds like a bargain, given that it sends you right off into the job market with skills that are worth a lot, doesn't it?
Well, and that's the same with where I went. I went to school. I mean, it cost me $40,000, but it was 10 years or 10 months, jumped right into it, didn't have to meet any sort of criteria other than you know, I had to know a little bit about how to work on vehicles.
Corey, you're making me curious all day long. You paid $40,000 for a set of training that you could have got for $5,000. Can you help me understand that one?
So my problem is that I don't meet the criteria to go to a, say, college, like Clark College, PCC, all of that.
Okay.
So I had
so you went somewhere else and paid, and they took you in because you had $40,000, not because – I guess I'd ask you this, Corey. I have great respect for people working in the trades. An awful lot of people work in the trades. We don't need to send as many people to four-year colleges as we do currently because the economy doesn't have demand for it. But tell me this, in your current job as a diesel mechanic, don't you have to be able to read really well, to read manuals, to read all the other things that go along with your job? Don't you have to be able to do some math?
Yes, sir, to a point.
To a point. So you could have limited reading skills, and when somebody walks in or drives in a vehicle that needs to be repaired, it doesn't matter if you can read the documentation for the vehicle or the documentation for the parts that you're going to put in it or what you're going to do. It doesn't matter. You don't need to know how to read that?
Yeah, to a point, but there's more technical technical words in there that you have to know what they mean, and they do teach you that.
Don't you have to read all the words around the technical words as well?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay, so would it be a good idea for all high school graduates to have fairly good reading skills and writing skills as well?
Yeah, is what I was trying to get that I don't agree with is that the standards nowadays are so high, and for anybody coming into high school and stuff like that, it's so difficult to pass those. Like, I passed my reading class with a D, with a 59, 60%, and that was barely passing, and it was just so difficult in order to...
And we should lower the standard from that and make it lower. Interesting naysayer, Corey. You're probably the most interesting naysayer so far this month. Back in just a moment. I'll get to more of your phone calls and emails. We have things to talk about, and it's the Radio Northwest Network. Coming up, a carpetbagger who wants to run for governor here in the Northwest. Welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network. You know we're going to be talking about politics this year as it's an election year, and I've already told you what I think about one of the potential candidates, the carpetbagger from New York City by the name of Nicholas Kristof. And I used to debate against him in high school. That we've already talked about, the idea of his residency being in question because the Secretary of State has said, now he's not qualified to run for the office because the Constitution says he had to live here for 3 years. So I'm not going to spend as much time talking about that, probably none, as I talked to Brent Walt, the former managing editor at Willamette Week and a longtime Oregon journalist, now assistant professor at the Catalyst Journalism Project at the University of Oregon School of Journalism, who just wrote a piece for Politico.com about Nicholas Kristof. Brent and I have known each other for decades, and it's great to welcome you back to the program. Brent, welcome.
Hey, Lars. It's great to be back. You know, we used to do this almost every week when I was at Willamette Week. It was, it's nice to be back.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to have you back. But tell me this: you decided to, and as I said, the residency thing—that's before the Oregon Supreme Court. It'll be decided. We've already discussed it at length. Tell me this: you decided to do a story on Nick Kristof. How did you go about doing that, and why were you doing that story on Kristof?
Well, I was fortunate. Politico reached out to me and asked me in October if I would write a story about him in his candidacy. And at that time, the question was, you know, why is he doing this? You know, people on the East Coast, people in politics, knew him well, didn't understand why he would be leaving this prime job, this position of being on the New York Times op-ed page, writing articles that make a huge difference in the world. And his stories, his work, it may have a lot of impact. That was the initial idea. And I realized that he was running a lot. A lot of the reason that is to say, it was with a book he'd written in 2020 with his wife called Tightrope, which is about what happened to friends of his growing up in Yamhill because of what he accounted as a loss of family wage jobs, addiction, alcoholism, a lot of other factors that he attributed to a great degree to sort of a failure of government to help people who needed help. And that was his primary reason for wanting to run. That's what we were hearing.
And you, he's also said, look, I'm deeply connected to my community, to my hometown. Aside from the technical residency requirements, which, as we said, are going to be resolved some other way, he says, look, I'm really connected to this town of Yamhill. I've got a farm there, and he claims to have been an Oregon resident even during all the times, decades, that he traveled elsewhere. So did he know the town well when you went out to find out if either he knew the town well or the town knew him at all?
That's a great question, you know, and I wanted to talk to him about the reasons he was running, because the reasons were very much connected to Yamhill, which people know is Yamhill County. It's a town of about 1,100 people. His family farm was a few miles outside of town, but the whole community is known as Yamhill. And I asked, you know, when I write a profile of somebody, I want them to be the first person I talk to. I don't want to talk to much. I want to sit down with them and really get to know them. And he declined to be interviewed. His campaign continually either didn't respond or declined to my requests. So I said, well, I'm going to go out to the Yamhill and talk to people who know him. And that's what I did. I talked to several people, but the first thing I did was I got a copy of his yearbook off of eBay, senior yearbook, and who he went to high school with, and called a bunch of folks, talked to them. But going to Yamhill, who knows the town best but the mayor? So I sat down with the mayor at coffee and talked to her about Christoph, and I was surprised by what I found.
What'd you find? I mean, this is a town that's 3 blocks long. The main street is 3 blocks long. Of course, there are houses around that, but it's a small town. You could probably walk down and talk to every store owner in an afternoon. So when you sat down to talk to the mayor, what did she know about him?
Well, she knew that he lived nearby, but he was not somebody who played any kind of role in the community. And if you read Tightrope, you would get the impression that he was very connected to the community. But if you talk to people who are in fact connected, she said he wasn't present. She'd never met him, and he hadn't really played a role in the community. And I was quite surprised by that. I expected the complete opposite. And I didn't know what quite to make of that, but as I kept doing my reporting, I began to realize that this could be saying something about his, not just his claim of residency, Lars, but what I think the larger question that Christoph faces is one of authenticity. Can he articulate the problems that Oregon is facing? Yeah, I think he does a pretty good job articulating them. Can he show that he can do something about them? I think voters are going to have to decide. But the question of authenticity, not just whether he meets a residency requirement, but will he be able to convince voters that he is truly understands the state? I think the mayor's comments and her observations kind of really spoke to that. And when I talked to Christoph, I finally did get an interview with him after some amount of effort. He acknowledged that he didn't know the mayor, never met her, and
didn't know her name, did he?
I thought the readers might consider that to be an interesting fact. So,
I mean, when you brought up her name, Nick Christoph didn't know the name of the mayor of the town that he lives 3 miles outside of.
That's right.
Right?
Yes.
What does that, I guess I'd wonder, what does that say about whether or not somebody can connect? Because you and I have covered politics for a long time in this state, and one of the biggest problems is the governors of the state tend to focus on the big metro areas. They focus on Eugene, they focus on Salem, they focus on Portland, and they, for the most part, ignore the rest of the state. Is that a problem for somebody who says, well, I'm from rural Oregon, but he's right outside the Portland metro and doesn't connect to his own community? Is he going to be able to connect to the rest of the state?
Well, and that was a key question for me. And I was very concerned when I wrote this story that this was going to feel like a gotcha story, like, oh, you don't know the mayor. But that wasn't really it. This isn't about a civics test, right? We could ask candidates whether they know it's a state bird, and we hope they would answer Western Meadowlark. But really, it's a question of whether or not they understand what communities are concerned about. The town of Yamhill has some very particular problems. Like their water supply is right now, it become kind of a crisis for them, particularly in drought, you know. But they also have issues that are true about all towns of that size. When kind of help do we need from the feds? What kind of help can the state provide? And it's those kind of thematic issues, as well as what it might be happening in a particular town, whether it's Carlton or it's Yamhill or Sheridan or whatever. Anybody running for office get close enough to begin to understand those things? And you could simply say this is early in the campaign for him. He still has a lot to learn. But as you said, I thought it would be interesting for people to know that in this town that he's very connected to, and he's making the case that as a resident here, that, you know, he's tied to it. It doesn't seem that way to a lot of people who are living the experiences of that town every day.
It sounds like, to me, it sounds like marketing for the book, that when he wrote the book Tightrope, he wanted to say, look, I'm connected to this small town. That sounds very romantic. Like, I've gone back to my small town from the big city, and I've found my friends from high school that didn't do very well, and now I'd like to try to help them out by suggesting ways that we can change. And now I've decided, having made my fame and fortune in the big city, I'm going to come back and run for governor and be able to actually, you know, do something with the state. Brent, I want you to stay through the break, if you don't mind. I'm talking to assistant professor at the University of Oregon Journalism School, an old friend of mine, and he's written a piece recently on this Nick Kristof, who wants to run for Oregon governor, even though at this point he legally doesn't qualify, but the Supreme Court will decide that. We'll talk about a few other issues involving Nick Kristof coming up in a moment. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network. I'm talking to, and I'll admit, a longtime friend of mine, Brent Walt, the author of Fire at Eden's Gate, which is a book about the great Tom McCall, who I thought was a fantastic politician, although he's a good journalist as well. Brent is the assistant professor of journalism at the Catalyst Journalism Project at the U of O School of Journalism. Brent, we've been talking about Nick Kristof. I want to ask you about something. Kristof, and again, we were talking about how he's going to connect to the state and whether or not what he thinks or says about the state is going to be relevant and whether he can make it seem relevant to voters. That's assuming the Supreme Court gives him the clearance to run. If he doesn't run, then it's not important at all what he thinks. But he said that Oregon has always been kind of a progressive place. And that's always struck me as a little strange. And I want to get your perspective on this, because he grew up as the son, correct me if I'm wrong, of a college professor who also had a farm in rural Oregon. Now, I think it's a little different when you're a farmer and you make your living from the ground and you depend on the vagaries of the weather and the marketplace and everything else, versus if you have a paycheck coming from somewhere else and you have a farm because it's kind of fun to be a farmer. And I think Nick Kristof is in the same boat. He's a guy who's, you know, I assume he's relatively wealthy from his job at the New York Times and his books and his speeches and everything else. Good for him. I don't begrudge him a dime of that. But to say I connect with farmers because I have a gentleman's farm is not the same as being able to connect with, say, Klamath Falls, connect with Eastern Oregon, connect with water issues and real issues when you come at it from a big city perspective.
Well, I want to step back on this for just a second.
Sure.
If you listen to Kristof's story, his father wanted to own a farm for very personal reasons about his background. And I'm not going to doubt or question Nick Kristof's understanding or commitment. This is a guy who sat out his first year at Harvard and spent the whole year as a state representative for Future Farmers of America. He knows these issues, you know, I think really well. Whether you can connect or not is something that voters are going to have to decide. I want to go back to something you said earlier. Because he doesn't know something about civic issues in Yamhill, I don't think it reflects on his sincerity about writing about these friends that he lost and his concerns. I think his concerns are sincere. I believe these are real issues. And what Kristof, if he stays in the race, will do is add a level and degree of debate. And that is not going to be present if we just have the current crop of Democrats and to some degree Republicans in the race. Kristof's voice, whether you agree with him, you think he should be in the race or not, he's going to add something that has been missing from Oregon politics for a long time. And
what is that? What is the thing
adds? One of the things he said to me is that, we haven't really had people truly speaking up about what is not only concerns us about Oregon, but what direction we want to go. And you can agree or disagree with his analysis of why things are so why so many things seem to be at a crisis level in the state. But he's willing to come from the outside and talk about it. You know, one of the benefits he brings as a journalist is not only is he really good at analyzing problems, which, as you know, journalists are great at characterizing what's wrong. But Christoph has always practiced what is kind of what we call a form of solutions-oriented reporting. He's also reporting toward things that have been proven to work to address problems. And I've seen him try to bring some of that out in what he's been talking about in the campaign. I think part of the challenge is the focus. He hasn't done much of that. He's not done much interacting with the media. And so much of the focus has been on his residency issues that people haven't heard that yet. Whether you're convinced by it, whether it would persuade you to vote for him, is another issue, but that will be missing if he's not in the race.
Brent, the problem I see with that is, number one, he comes at his Oregon's always been progressive. We're going to have more of the progressiveness. From my perspective, the progressiveness is what has destroyed a lot of the state. A lot of the industries in the state have been destroyed by it. Lately, Tina Kotek and everybody else supporting higher taxes is probably what made Intel go build their shiny new fab in Ohio instead of Oregon, where they literally have their biggest worker group of people in the United States. Why are they leaving? Because the place is anti-business. The progressiveness has laid waste to the state, not just the extractive industries like mining, fishing, farming, timber, and everything else. And if he says, we're going to bring more progressiveness, that's all you need is more progressive, more government, more rules, more taxes. If that's his approach, if he's saying we haven't been nearly progressive enough, well, that is just going to lay waste to the state some more. And when you say people haven't spoken up, talk to Timber Unity. Regular protests at the state capitol. I mean, hundreds and thousands of people going to the state capitol saying, will you please listen to us? We've got real issues out here. And people like Kate Brown have been tone deaf to all of that.
Well, what I totally understand the perspective you're bringing to that. And I can't speak for Christoph when he talks about looking back at what Oregon has been able to accomplish in the past. One thing I, again, careful not to speak for him, but what I think I hear him saying is Oregon was a place that could find a way to solve its problems, and that it has not been able to do so. Now, I'm not going to get into a debate with you about what the right answers are, whether the current crop of politicians are listening or not listening. But what I'm saying is that in the Democratic primary, at a minimum, his presence will add a depth and an agenda, a series of things to talk about that won't otherwise get talked about.
Well, I hope you're right. We're up against the break, Brent. We're hard up against the break. I hope you're right and that he brings some new ideas. But if I hear him with more of the same stuff that Kotek and Tobias Reed and Kate Brown have been pushing, I don't see how that changes things. It's just more progressiveness. That's Brent Wolf. His piece is in Politico. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails. You would think by this time, by this point in the pandemic, now just about 2 years into it, that we would be past a lot of issues, including issues about mandates, whether it's mask mandates that are being struck down right and left by courts high and low, whether or not it's vaccine mandates, things like that. But no, there's still a real issue for an awful lot of workers, and especially here in the Pacific Northwest. There are companies that have said, if the mandates are gone, we're not going to enforce them anymore. Starbucks did exactly that. And you might not have expected it. Carhartt, on the other hand, an American company, said, no, we're going to go ahead with the vaccine mandate, even though OSHA's mandate was struck down by the United States Supreme Court. So when I got this email from Mary, not her real name, but we've allowed her to use a pseudonym today, she works in the grocery business. And I thought I wanted to share her story with you. So, Mary, welcome to the program.
Hi, Lars. Thanks for having me on your show today.
Why'd you write to me, and what did you want to tell not just me, but I assume my audience as well, about your situation and the people who work around you? And I don't mind if you mention the name of the company you work for.
Sure. I'm speaking up as a voice for several New Seasons Market employees who are not okay with a new policy that was just announced last week, despite the recent Supreme Court ruling. So the policy requires all employees in Oregon and Washington to provide proof of vaccination to work or apply for exemption.
And what's the
several
deadline?
Employees,
oh, sorry.
The No, go ahead. Deadline is March 17th.
March 17th. I mean, the pandemic is fading right now. I'm not even sure where we'll be by the Ides of March, but
It certainly seems like that's a strange thing. The original mandate from OSHA was the 4th of January, and we've long gone past that. Has the company explained to the workers what it is they want to achieve and whether or not they're going to fire anybody who doesn't go along with it?
They have said there will be disciplinary action up to termination if you don't, you know, go one way or the other with the vaccination or with the exemption. But the problem is that many of my coworkers are sick with COVID-19 right now, even though they are fully vaccinated and have received one or more boosters. So why are they implementing the policy now? And we're upset for a lot of reasons, but a big one is that we're being required to take a vaccine that doesn't actually prevent you from getting COVID-19. And many of the employees have natural immunity from working with the public this entire time.
Because they, in many cases, probably got it along the way,
exactly.
And they have natural immunity.
Correct.
So has the company, have they given you any idea of whether they're going to honor the exemptions that you mentioned if people actually ask for them?
They haven't said one way or the other, but I know a lot of people are really scared and skeptical as to how many of the exemptions will be accepted. So many employees are exempt from this vaccine, and on top of that, a lot of people are exempt from the current testing method as well, which is the nasal swab. So the big thing that a lot of people have said to me is that they're really frustrated that when everyone can get and spread the virus, forcing only some employees to test regularly is clearly discrimination. So there's no logical reason why, you know, we should be doing this to just some people. I'm against testing for everybody personally, but I just feel like if you're going to test some people, then you should be testing all the people.
The other strange thing that's popped up, and, you know, a year and a half ago, none of us, I think, could have imagined these things, is that I'm hearing from healthcare workers. They're saying the hospital is letting sick people come back, even if they've got COVID. But if they're vaccinated, they come back. If they can't, they're banned. Has New Seasons told you what their policy is on that? Are they working people who are positive on this because they've been vaccinated?
No, our company is not doing that, but I have heard that that's happening at especially medical facilities and whatnot. But we're not a medical facility. We're a grocery store. And we just feel like this should be a personal choice, and medical overreach has no place in a grocery store. It's ridiculous.
What does management say when you tell them that?
Well, we're going to find out, because there is a large and growing group of us who are fed up with this, and we're here to say that this is not okay. It's discriminatory. It's unconstitutional. It goes against all of our company values, and we're demanding that this policy be retracted immediately.
Well, I'm with you. I think you ought to have the choice of whether or not you want to do that, and it sounds like they may end up giving you the choice in the form of a pink slip. Are you ready for that?
I'm absolutely ready. There's no way I'm backing down.
What about your coworkers? Oh, and by the way, you in your email wrote to me and you said you estimate the number of people who are unvaccinated and steadfast in their dedication not to take it is 25 or 30% of the workforce?
Well, we don't know that company-wide, but we know at certain locations that the number is at least 10 to 20%. And so it's a significant group of people. And unfortunately, a lot of the people are being coerced into doing something that they don't want to do. A lot of people have had problems with doing it already, and have even said, I wish I wouldn't have done it. Or I have done it and I haven't seen any results. I still got sick. So if I was going to get sick anyways, why did I do this?
Yeah, because the vaccine has some side effects as well. Is there anything else you wanted to tell folks, Mary? Because I appreciate you coming on, I mean, even though we had to give you a new name and all.
No problem. I just appreciate the time and the platform, and I just want to say for all the employees pushing back on the policy, this is about freedom for us, freedom of choice, freedom to work, and medical freedom. And we're hoping that regardless of people's vaccination status, our other coworkers, our customers, and good citizens out in the Portland, Vancouver area will come and join us and support, as we're here to tell them, no, you cannot do this to us.
By the way, one last question. Do you think this, I mean, New Seasons is a different kind of company, if I'm not mistaken, you know, that they're not just we're a grocery store that sells groceries. They've got a different point of view, both about employees, about suppliers, and about their customers. Do they not?
Yeah, we have a really strong speak-up culture at New Seasons Market, and just the fact that we got to this point without asking the employees, you know, regardless of how you feel about unions, you know, somebody should have asked us how we felt about it before we went through with something like this, which is going to significantly impact people's lives.
I'd have to agree with you. I mean, that's the only point. And Mary, I've always said every American can join a union. I think it's foolish, but I mean, it's your choice. It's a constitutional right, freedom of association, freedom of, so that you, if you want to get together with like-minded people and support whatever cause you want, it's certainly legal. It's allowed under the Constitution. It's allowed under the law. I've got no objection to it at all. My issues with unions are more to do with unions and public employment. But Mary, best of luck to you and stay in touch and let us know what happens. Would you please?
Absolutely. Thank you, Lars.
Glad to have you on. That is Mary, pseudonym, for a young lady who works at the grocery store chain New Seasons, and they're saying, you've got to be vaccinated by the 17th of March. You got to give us proof a month earlier by the 17th of February. If you don't, you could be terminated. And you think that's the right thing to do for any company, especially given where this whole discussion has gone, both in the courts and among, you know, people in the general society. Glad to be with you. Always glad to take your calls. We'll get to those next at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. If you want to join in the show, we call it the best conversation in talk journalism at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers always go to the head of the line. I'm going to get to a naysayer here in just a moment at 866-439-5277. If not that, you can email talk@LarsLarson.com. You can always vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. I'm sorry, Getter, where we are present, but Getter does not yet have the ability to host our daily poll. But when it does, we'll be moving it from Twitter, believe me. Or you can go to my website at LarsLarson.com. So last week, I talked about a change that federal licensing authorities, the federal government, is making to the CDL, the commercial driver's license. It makes it possible. Right now, under a CDL, if you have one at age 18, you can drive a truck, but you can't cross a state line. Now, you can understand the problems with that because you might be able to drive, depending on the state you're in, hundreds of miles within a state, but you can't cross that state line. In the eastern United States, you cross the state lines a whole lot more frequently because the states are a whole lot smaller than they are out west. So the change they're going to make by federal regulation, it's not a move by Congress, but the federal motor carrier licensing authorities have said they want to make it possible for 18-year-olds to drive big rig trucks across state lines. And I said, I happen to agree with the idea. I'm not a CDL. My father-in-law was. My stepson is a CDL holder. And I don't see the problem because the second thing you've got to do is take that shiny new CDL, let's say 18 or 19 or 20 years of age, and go to a company that will trust you to drive their very expensive truck with usually very expensive cargo on board across state lines and drive it perhaps hundreds and hundreds of miles. So you'd have to have both of those things happen. I know people are concerned about safety and maturity and that sort of thing, but I happen to agree with the idea. And I got a lot of feedback, both for and against, including what I considered a well-reasoned email from Army aviation veteran Robert Moran, who listens to the show. He said, Lars, as a recently retired Army aviator and aviation safety officer, I know that the Army, through a selection process, frequently places flight school students in helicopters at ages as young as 18 years of age with great success. Individuals are evaluated and then selected to attend flight school. There are a series of check rides and tests to ensure the individual's ability to operate the aircraft and ensure safety, maturity, and knowledge as they progress to a full mission-capable pilot. These students are evaluated at every phase. They receive training if needed before advancing to the next phase. This check and balance system continues throughout one's career annually with no notice evaluations periodically. My point is, there are many professions that young individuals choose that are considered dangerous, and these individuals need to be evaluated on their ability, maturity, and knowledge before they're selected to join. Our society has gone soft, and I think that if individuals want to join these professions, let them. The companies will assume the risk once a driver's navigated through the gates of the onboard training. Any good company is not going to toss the keys to a new driver with zero experience and let them drive across the country in inclement weather. My grandfather started driving a bread truck around 16 and made long-haul truck driving a career. I've always wondered, at what point do we mitigate a risk so much that we become a hazard to ourselves? Very well said. We need leaders who will accept residual risk in real time and allow individuals to employ their training to accomplish the task at hand. Thank you for your time and have a blessed day. And the same to you, to Robert Moran. That was very well stated and better than I did. So I wanted to share that with you. Now, I want to go to your calls, and we always start with a naysayer if there is one. Hey, Will, welcome to the program. If you're a naysayer, we disagree. What do we disagree about today?
I disagree on the effort that you put in to categorize Biden as, you know, disrespectful.
A jerk.
For that comment. Yeah.
Well, let's start with this. Was the reporter's question a reasonable question?
I don't remember the exact thing, but I can
state it for you. Peter Ducey, I don't know the man personally. I've met his dad, but I don't know Peter Ducey. He said, is inflation, we're now at a 40-year high for inflation in America, thanks to Joe Biden, is inflation a political liability for Democrats this fall? Now, is that a reasonable question to ask?
That's a fine question, and Biden did, unfortunately, say something very stupid. But the difference between him and Trump is that he actually called the man and apologized personally. Trump would never do that.
Well,
so, yes, he made a mistake.
But you'd have to tell me what Trump said that he should apologize for. If he said many of these people in the media are lying to you, he was right about that. Should he apologize for saying that?
I mean, he's called the entire media the enemy of the people. Like, what kind of child says that?
I don't think that Trump's ever said everybody in the media, because there are clearly people he thinks report honestly and accurately, and I've heard him say that a number of times. But an awful lot of media in America tells information to the public that deceives them. And you and I could spend hours talking about all the deceptions we've seen just in the last 12 months, let alone the last 12 years. So I don't see any need for Trump to apologize. But when Joe Biden responded by sarcastically saying, inflation, no, it's an asset, and he said it sarcastically, and then he called Ducey a stupid son of a bitch. Now, that, I think, did merit an apology, but what kind of child or mental incompetent decides that a reasonable question should be answered by calling the person a stupid son of a bitch?
So, yes, once every month, Biden says something really stupid compared to Trump, which says something incredibly worse every
day.
Well,
hold on. Will, 1 year and 4 days ago, roughly, Joe Biden came into the White House on his very first day in office and said, if anybody treats anybody around them, from my team, treats anybody with disrespect, I will fire them on the spot. You think maybe Joe Biden should fire himself on the spot for that disrespect he showed to a reasonable question?
I don't see how that's comparable, but I
sure
guess,
it is. He's
I
got the 25th Amendment. He could fire himself right now. And why not?
Well,
he was calling out saying, I'm bringing decency back to the White House. Has he done that?
I absolutely think he, for all his faults, yes, he has done.
Can you give me an example of him bringing, was it decent for him to say in mid-August, just a few months ago, I will not leave Afghanistan until we get all of the Americans out? Was it decent for him to lie through his teeth and say that when he knew he had no intention of doing it at all?
No, that was bad, but I mean,
was it a good idea for Joe Biden to say, we are not going to have any mandates, we will not have a vaccine mandate in America, knowing that he was going to go back on that one almost immediately? Was that a decent thing to do on a major issue involving tens of millions of people?
That's a policy issue that changes with what's called science.
What policy? Why was, if in July he said that we are not going to have a mandate, what changed that made the mandate necessary or advisable? Or do you think he was just lying through his teeth?
Probably the fact that the scientists at the CDC or wherever probably said, look, we're going to have less deaths if we have the vaccine. Do whatever you can.
Have we had less deaths under Joe Biden than Donald Trump?
I'm
just asking if we have less deaths. Trump had to fight it most of the year without a vaccine. Joe Biden's had a vaccine since day one, and more people have died. And do you think that's a decent thing for Joe Biden? You're a great naysayer, Will, absolutely prove my point. 866-HEY-LARS. Send your emails. talk@LarsLarson.com on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Of course, naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show or at LarsLarson.com if you don't like Twitter. You can also send me emails, talk@LarsLarson.com. I can only honestly say that I've been racially discriminated against one time in my life that I know of. But it's one of those things that I didn't take kindly to. So when I hear that we may have the chance to actually end something that I think is racially discriminatory, and that's affirmative action, because the Supreme Court has agreed to take up a case. Now, they're going to hear the case, and then we're not going to hear a decision until probably June of 2024. I don't like the idea of it hanging around that long, but that's what the Supreme Court does. They have kind of an easy workload. Mike Gonzalez joins me now, who's senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and the author of the new book, BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. Mike, welcome back.
Hey, Lars, it's great to have be on with you again. And this is, yeah, this is a big case at the Supreme Court. I think a lot of us who have been following the Harvard case for many years now have been waiting for this moment, and we're hopeful that a solution will finally be found to this disgrace of racial preferences.
Well, let me sketch it out for people who haven't heard, because you and I have talked about it so much we kind of take for granted that everybody else knows it. But Harvard University literally says to kids, young men and women who want to go to college, they say, well, you can come, but you have to have the right kind of scores, you know, test scores, GPA, and all that. And they say, but if you have the kind of scores that would get you in if you were black or brown, you got to have even better scores to get in if you're white, and especially good scores if you're Asian. I would think that anybody, any lawyer, not even a Supreme Court justice, would look at that and say, you can't do that. That's not legal. That's not a legitimate way to make the decisions. And yet they've been doing it for some time, haven't they?
Yeah, they don't say it exactly like that, but the numbers bear out exactly what you just said. The numbers are very clear. They look at your grades and look at your SAT, and that's an objective thing. And they look at your number of hours doing voluntary work, again an objective thing. And then they've created this third area, characteristics, personal characteristics. So you're interviewed, and it turns out that a lot of Americans of Asian ancestry get dinged for well, he's not leadership material, not humorous enough, or too humorous, or things like that are not objective. And I think that is the realization that this racial discrimination is taking place with a group of people who, by the way, even though Asian Americans have been in this country for many, many decades, today's Asian Americans are mostly, over 90%, are either first generation, that is the immigrant, yep, or second generation, the child of the immigrant. And over 90% of Asian Americans are in other words, they came here recently, they have worked really hard, they've assimilated, and now they're being told, no, you cannot go to Harvard, or you cannot go to Stanford, or you cannot go to Yale. So the injustice of this is just too glaring for the court not to step in and say, enough's enough.
Well, and by the way, we're talking about these big Ivy League schools, but it's not just the Ivy League. Would you say it's fair to say that most state-operated, in other words, taxpayer-funded colleges and universities practice some brand of this same kind of discrimination?
Yeah, and the Supreme Court has said it's okay to use it as one of many elements, right? A plus factor to use it as long as it's because it's gone through strict scrutiny. There's a government interest in this taking place, but I think that has opened a hole through which to drive the truck of injustice through, and I think we have to go back to saying no, the Civil Rights Act, with the Civil Rights Movement, the Civil Rights Era was fought to ensure that government would never again follow policies, apply, you know, and apply policies that were race conscious. We need to have in a society such as ours that is multi-ethnic, we need to be colorblind. And I think the reason of that is going to be too important for the court to avoid.
Well, and yet, Mike, when we say colorblind, that was what I was always told. This is what the society is, where you can walk in and apply for a job or buy a house or take out a loan or do any of the things we all want to do, and that you could do it and they wouldn't pay attention to your race or your ethnicity or your skin color. And yet the left seems to actually desire a society that is anything but colorblind, don't they?
No, very much. And under Biden, it is explicitly that way. They use the word equity, which I think your listeners are probably aware of this, because you have really good listeners, but it's become the functional opposite of equality. Equity means the government should treat Americans differently depending on what racial or ethnic category the government has put them in. And that is that's what President Biden, but especially Vice President Harris, want and say they want. So yes, and we see this now, for example, with COVID treatment. With COVID treatment, they're saying, well, being a member of one of the marginalized groups puts you – it's a risk factor. I'm sorry. That is – first of all, that's racist. Just because your surname is Gonzalez – doesn't mean that that is a risk factor. What the hell is that? I mean,
well, and Mike, I mean, for example, pick any famous celebrity who's a person of color, Tiger Woods or Denzel. You think Denzel Washington has any problem with getting access to health care? Do you think he could probably call? I mean, given his position and his wealth, he could probably say, I'd like a doctor to come right to my bedside. And I'll bet he can get it through concierge care. And you say, no, but your skin color is it's a barrier to you getting health care. No, it's not. On the other hand, if you're the poor white person who lives in a trailer park somewhere and works at a minimum wage job part time, I'll bet there are lots of barriers to entry. And they have nothing to do with your skin color. They have everything to do with other factors that that have anything to do except ethnicity and race.
Yeah, Politico, bless their soul, has a story out today, which I've been tweeting it, because they talk about this, but they frame the story as Republicans pounds. Republicans have discovered something that is going to be politically disadvantageous for Democrats, their embrace of race-conscious policies. Oh, my God! Yeah, it should be disadvantageous politically to demand race conscious policies, because it's racist and the American voter understands that. But it's political. Instead of writing a story saying the left is making a humongous error by embracing racist policies and is going to pay for it at the polls, no, it just around says, "Oh, Republicans pounds."
You know, it's funny. I looked up the numbers the other day. My mom was a registered nurse, an RN. And I looked up the numbers because I never want to quote a bad number. About 90% of RNs are women. Should we start to ban women from getting into the nursing profession until we come up to close to 50% with men? And I think most people say, well, that's goofy. That's stupid. I'd say, I agree. It's stupid. But if you want to follow the same policies, you say men are being denied the entry into the nursing field. What's that?
I have long been very concerned about the sexual disparities in sanitation work and among roofers.
No doubt. That's Mike Gonzalez's new book is called BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. He's with Heritage. We'll be back to your phone calls in a moment at 866-439-5277. It's the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I knew I'd probably get some naysayers because a subject that I brought up last week that was about something that I think is hugely critical to the United States, the supply chain crisis. At least a big chunk of that crisis, I think, has been caused by the fact that we don't have enough truck drivers. Now, the numbers go anywhere from 80,000 shortfall to up to 200,000 shortfall. So last week when I saw that the Federal Motor Carrier, I can't remember the name of the whole federal agency, but they changed the rules. and they said they're going to change the rules. This is not a vote of Congress, as some people apparently thought. It was a federal agency saying, we will now allow you to get a CDL at 18 or 19 or 20 that will allow you to drive a big rig across state lines. And I said, I think that's a perfectly acceptable idea, given that once you have that CDL, it doesn't mean that any company in the world is simply going to throw you the keys when you're 18 and say, go ahead, take our $150,000 big rig, drive it across state lines with, I don't know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars of cargo on board. They're going to have to trust you as well. But I said, this seems like a generally good idea. So the fact that I've got a naysayer named Ann, who's joined me now. Ann, I want to hear the argument against it. Is that what we disagree about today?
In part. I've had my CDL now for 16 years. I'm also a driver trainer. So I've got a little bit of experience with this. If you take a older new driver versus a young new driver, the vast majority of incidents and accidents out there are happening with the younger, less experienced drivers. And that's a recipe for disaster. I see it every day. Our company alone, most of the accidents that we're having are with the younger, inexperienced drivers.
Well, and I mean, in general, about even if you're talking about driving a passenger car, when you're 16 and you haven't faced, you know, the real world experience of driving on ice or driving in, you know, in the dark or driving in the rain or in bad weather or in terrible conditions or whatever, the more of that experience you get, I think makes you a better driver. But if a company...
They don't have that from the age of 18 to 20. They just don't have that experience.
But at 21, you can get a full CDL, right?
Correct. And even very few of those drivers have the experience to be able to handle what happens out here on the road.
Okay, so do you think the change should not be made to the CDL license, allowing a company, if they trust a 19-year-old? No?
Because overall, insurance rates will go up, wages will go down, and accidents will increase. I've seen it.
Well, you can't have seen it yet with this change because the change hasn't happened yet,
I've
right?
seen it with the younger, inexperienced drivers already because they've eliminated the one-year over-the-road requirement for local drivers. Now they've reduced that to just 3 months of general driving. And it's the younger drivers that are coming in with that less than 3 months experience that are having more incidents and accidents versus the older, more mature drivers coming in with that 3 months experience.
What did you think of...
They don't have the life experience younger.
Well, then, I mean, should we move the CDL age to 25 or maybe to 30 and say you've got to have so much local experience, years of local experience before you're allowed to drive, no matter how mature and no matter how capable you can show yourself to be? I guess you're making the argument, it sounds to me like we ought to move the age from 21 to some number that's higher than that. Why not?
No, there's no problem leaving it at 21. What they need to do is keep that over-the-road experience as a requirement.
But you can't get the over-the-road experience until you can drive over the road, right?
There are companies that will hire you at 21 to drive over the road.
Right. And you're saying that's dangerous because it's causing an increase in accidents. Did I hear you right?
Generally, yes, more so locally.
And yet there are companies that are willing...
They've eliminated the one-year requirement.
And yet there are companies that say, we're willing to take the risk... We understand the risks and the rewards, and they've chosen to hire younger drivers without as much experience, and they're willing to take that risk. Is that a vote in favor of
and
younger
unfortunately,
ages?
Unfortunately, they're paying the price for that risk.
But they're willing to pay it, aren't they?
The problem is not only have they eliminated the one-year over-the-road experience requirement to drive locally, they're hiring drivers with little to no experience on top of that. So, yeah, they may be willing to take that risk. But are you, while you're driving down the road as one of those 18-year-old kids who doesn't have a clue what he's doing?
I'm concerned about those people.
Them.
I'm also
concerned. I personally am not willing to take that risk.
Okay, but, Ann, remember that I understand the physical danger. I don't want to get run over by an 18-wheeler, whether it's driven by somebody who's 50 or 25. On the other hand, if the companies have made they've weighed the risk, because understand, the company is saying, we've got a $150,000 brand new truck. It's full of tens of thousands of dollars.
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, and we have insurance to pay. They've said, yes, even adding in all that, the desire to get new drivers or enough drivers is enough to have us take that risk, and we think it's because every company takes risks, right?
Then why don't we just go ahead and lower the drinking age to 17 or 18 also?
But I think drinking is an entirely different thing because I've met very mature 18-year-olds. I've met idiots who are 28, you know,
That's
who don't have any maturity at all.
21 is a better age. They're more mature. They have more experience driving. They have more experience backing a vehicle. In general, 21 and over, they have more experience.
Okay.
I'm telling you, I've been in the passenger seat ready to jump out of my own truck with younger drivers who have little to no experience behind the wheel of my truck.
Let me ask you one last quick question because we're up against the break, Ann. When somebody shows up who's 19 under the new rules, will you turn that student away?
Well, no, because my employer is putting them in the truck with me. I can't turn them away. But you go darn well, and I make sure they know what the hell they're doing. Oops, I'm sorry. But most of them in general really don't because they don't have that experience.
And I got to go. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. Glad to have you with us. If you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And our Twitter poll today, should all electric customers through their utility bills pay to fund car chargers for a tiny, wealthy minority of owners? And if you said, who's got that crazy idea? Oh, it's already in law. In law, as of last year, when you pay your electric bill, you're making sure that some poor rich guy or gal with a Tesla has a car charger available to them. And if you say, why am I paying for their fueling? Nobody subsidized the fuel stations that supply my gasoline or diesel rig. And the answer is because electric cars are, well, they're the cat's meow right now with the politically correct class that basically runs Oregon and Washington, not so much in Idaho. In any case, welcome to the program. Today's Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show, and it's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, I have a bit of a dog in the fight in that I do like to hunt. I've hunted both bow and rifle, and every time I hunted with rifle in the Pacific Northwest, I bought a cougar tag. Now, have I ever actually got a shot on a cougar? The answer is no. And why? Well, because they prohibit, in both Oregon and Washington, the only effective way of hunting for cougar, and that is using dogs. You can talk to lots of people who've hunted their entire life and never got a shot on a cat because, for the most part, it just doesn't happen. Or if it happens, it's like winning the lottery or something. So when I saw this story about a bill in the Washington State Senate that would forbid local police from shooting cougar to keep people safe, I thought, we've got to talk to the guy who's right on the front lines of this, and that's Sheriff Bob Songer from Klickitat County. Sheriff, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Lars. Appreciate it.
It sounds almost like the Washington legislature, the folks in Olympia in this case, have aimed this law directly at you. Is that inaccurate?
No, it's spot on. You know, here we go again with the state agencies trying to dictate to an elected sheriff on how he or she is going to be enforcing state law in regards to dangerous wildlife that presents a threat to public safety, domestic animals, and livestock. It's crazy.
Would you mind describing, Sheriff, what you do to allow your deputies? I mean, and if you disagree with me, I framed it as you could walk around in the woods as a hunter with a rifle for a long time and never even lay eyes on a cat, let alone get a shot at him. What's the only effective way, and what do you deputize some of your deputies to go out and hunt them down? How do you do it?
Okay, I have, and these are volunteers, by the way, I have 140 posse members. Nine of those posse members are dog handlers. And you're not going to get a cat if you don't have a dog. It'd be a rarity, as you indicated. So when we get a complaint from a citizen, we respond to that complaint, the deputy does, and if they confirm that it's most likely a cougar, if the cat's not right there, based on what information the deputy gets, we call out one of the nine hound handlers and track the cat. In most cases, it's a cougar, once in a while a bear, but track the cat. And every time we do that, we invite the Washington State Game Department to come along with us. About 80% of the time, they haven't had the staff or the time. But once we do get a cougar, we take a GPS reading and we notify the wildlife department where the cat's located, the animal's located, and we follow that up with a report to them. So we've involved the Washington State Game Department in this program. But I got to tell you, the reason I established this program in 2019, Lars, was I was getting numerous complaints from citizens concerned about their safety, about their livestock, domestic pets, because we'd have a number of incidents. In one incident, we had a cougar kill five goats on school grounds in White Salmon. It was a 4-H project. Killed five goats. Finally, we were able to track that cat down and euthanize it. But the problem, and we've had numerous other animal attacks and animals killed and injured and so forth. One turkey hunter last year was turkey hunting. He turned around, and there's a cougar staring him right in the face. He kicked at it. The cat pawed at him, didn't hit him, and he jumped up, and the cat took off. But we've had close encounters like that. We've had five cougars that were taken out of underneath people's porches, under their trailers, and so forth. This is a safety problem. But it seems like the state, Miss Lee, the regional director of our area, I think what the problem is, to be quite candid with you, this is looking bad for the wildlife department, that the sheriff's program is successful. And she doesn't want the sheriff, and she's buddied up with Mountain Lion Foundation and some of these other far-left groups, and she does not want the sheriff the ability to use dogs to protect our citizens and stuff. And
Sheriff Songer, I'll tell you, I've got a bias, because one of the problems I had over 20 years ago in both Oregon and Washington outlawed dog hunting of cougar. I'd never gone on a cougar hunt, but I went on one. It was a bunch of wildlife biologists had put a new radio collar on a cat. And they could only find the cat with the radio collar that was already on it and dogs. And when they allowed the population of cats to explode from a couple of thousand to thousands, you know, 8,000 or 10,000 in Oregon, probably the same number in Washington, the number of game animals that I would also like to hunt, like deer and elk, are simply disappearing. And they're being eaten because the biologists say an average adult cougar needs one deer or elk a week. And if you do the math on that, 8,000 or 10,000 cats times 50 big game animals, you're going to decimate the population pretty quickly. So I'll admit I've got a bias in favor of controlling the population, not wiping it out, but controlling it severely.
Oh, I absolutely. And you are spot on with your thinking there. The problem is when they did away with illegal hound hunting for citizens over a couple decades ago, the population exploded. That cat does not have a predator. The only predator that cat has is a man with a gun. And so when they overpopulate, they look for new territories. I had one biologist say, well, Bob, you have to understand that that cat is just traveling through your town of Goldendale or White Salmon, whatever city it is. It's looking for territory. I said, no, you have to understand. When that cat's traveling through, it's hungry, and it's going to find food, whether it's a pet dog or whether it's a child out in the yard. That cat doesn't know the difference. All it sees is food. And if a cat or a child is moving quickly, that triggers the instinct to charge.
That is a dangerous situation. Sheriff Bob Songer, who's the sheriff in Klickitat County, the Washington legislature considering a bill that would make his active and successful management of cougars, mountain lions, illegal. So that what? We can just allow the population to grow even more. Sheriff Songer, thank you very much. We'll be back in just a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Last week, I brought up a topic that it's got a tail on it as long as you can imagine, because the federal government has decided that if you have a CDL, right now the rule is you can drive that truck, but you have to stay within state lines. Now they're saying, well, at 18, 19, or 20, if you can get a company to put you behind the wheel, you can have a license that will let you drive across state lines. A lot more
of an issue on the East Coast of America with smaller states than on the West Coast. And I get emails before I go to our naysayer, like this one from Greg at Umpqua Dairy. Lars, I was driving a truck at 19 with a chauffeur's license 44 years ago. I drove all over Portland, Salem, and Bend with a three-axle truck and a 45-foot trailer. I never had an accident in over 500,000 miles in 10 years of driving. Lots of capable young men that could be driving with proper training. Now, on that note, let's go to our naysayer, Brian. Brian, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What do you and I disagree about today? Is it trucks and drivers?
Basically, it's the age of the driver itself, Lars. I'm a retired driver. I ran coast to coast, roughly 5 million miles of experience, and I got hit by a rookie driver coming off of a mountain with no brakes while I was sitting still in a California weigh station. And the veteran that was training him had decided sleeping was more important than coaching that kid off that hill with that truck. To make matters worse, turns out the truck was uninsured. So I've spent 36 years living with injuries no one would fix.
I'm sorry to hear that,
not
Brian.
Even the government.
And obviously there were some laws being broken in that case because the company was required to have insurance. It didn't. The driver was supposed to have a trainer. Effectively, he didn't. But, Brian, I feel very badly for you about what happened to you, but it sounds like the rules were being broken already that created that situation.
Well, indeed, yes. California stopped me at the weigh station because the weigh station was full and I was out on the shoulder of the road. The rookie made the decision to travel the shoulder of the road to hit me and knock eight other trucks together because of the force and the fact that he had already lost his brakes. The insurance company had filed bankruptcy 48 hours prior to the accident, so the truck was officially uninsured. And to compound that, 3 years later in work comp in the state of Utah, the state of Utah discovered they had no subrogation rights because they had failed to name the Insurance Guarantee Association in the state legislature. So I got abandoned, along with my wife and my four children. I wasn't able
Brian,
to even have surgery to fix most of my injuries until I reached 62 and could force it on Medicaid.
Brian, I said.
Surgery 16 times
okay,
in four
Brian,
years. You do
Brian,
not want to give an 80,000-pound truck to an 18-year-old kid. You're asking him to fly an airplane on the ground, and he's not old enough to do that.
Brian.
He needs oodles and oodles.
I'll just let Brian
experience.
Finish up because Brian doesn't want to engage in a conversation. That's all right. Brian, the question is, though, when do you trust the kid? Do you trust him at 18, 20, 25, 30? Because what happened to you, Brian, could have happened with any driver. And in that case, you were actually talking about a driver who was allegedly being trained by somebody, and apparently he was not. And I'm sorry for the injuries that you suffered. Let's go to, is it Betty? Or Beat?
Hello?
Yes, what's your name?
Pete Wickersham.
Oh, Pete, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just going to comment. You know, I understand the difference between a 16-year-old, 18, 21. I was there. And I was a locomotive engineer promoted at the age of 18 for Santa Fe, Union Pacific, and Amtrak.
How much did your typical train weigh at that time? Just the engine was probably 1 million pounds, wasn't it?
Well, 358,000 pounds. Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Third of a million. Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah, we were up there, but, you know, you add them all together, you got a lot of weight. But the whole thing was, I was 18 years old. I was qualified on all of them. You learn a lot between 16 and 18, and you really learn a lot between 18 and 21. So my whole thing was, you know, they're talking experience. Well, you're not going to get it if you don't start then. You know,
That's
it's
true.
Like kids that maybe drive a go-kart when they're 8, 10 years old and everything and get their driver's license. And then we have kids now that don't even want to drive when they're 16.
I know people who were 30 who didn't have a driver's license that I've worked with, and it always amazes me because I thought that's one of the skills that makes you employable in today's society. I don't know how you can get to 30 without having a driver's license, but there you go. But if you've got a young man or woman who says, I want to drive those trucks, and the company trusts them, and they read the maturity of that person, because the thing I have a tough time imagining, Pete, everybody says, well, you just put that kid out there. No, you don't put that kid out there. Somebody who owns that $150,000, $200,000 big rig puts them in the truck with cargo on board that's worth a lot of money and with insurance bills they have to pay. The company has to be satisfied that you can do a safe job. Company doesn't want to wreck the truck. Company doesn't want to lose the cargo either. And they know they'll be out of business if they have very much of that.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. And, you know, these people, they think that these kids aren't smart enough to learn. They can learn. I've seen them do it. You can put them on a go-kart. You can put them on a little side-by-side, and they learn very quick at that age. We got to give them a chance. Our economy depends on it right now. And it's kind of a must-must.
Yeah, and even the people who say, well, make them go to training school, the gentleman who called a moment ago who was so grievously injured by an accident that he didn't create, he was parked by the side of the road, but there was somebody who training a kid who apparently was not doing his job, and there was a company that didn't have insurance, and there was an insurance company that wasn't backed up, and there was a legislature that didn't do its job, and there was a way station that had people's trucks stacked up onto the freeway, and all of those things are wrong. But they're already against the rules. So, it's not that I don't feel for the guy, but I say if you got hurt because multiple people, multiple entities, you know, government agencies and all that, didn't do their job, didn't follow the rules alone aren't going to save you.
That is correct. That is 100% correct. It's not going to save you. We got to train the kids. We got to have to make it happen for them. And, I can see the liabilities, I can see everything, but they got to learn somewhere. They don't learn by sitting behind a book.
And there's actually a school, we've talked to the high school here in the Northwest, that actually starts to put young men and women, not with a license, but young men and women behind the wheel of a big rig. And we talked to them because I thought, this is a great idea. I mean, it isn't going to be every kid, but if some of the kids in a high school say, you know what? I want to drive truck. I want to drive those big trucks that I see on the freeway. If you got one kid out of 100 to do that in every high school in America, you'd probably solve the driver shortage fairly quickly. And some of them would decide, man, I don't want to do this. I've tried it. And others would decide, no, this is great. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to make $100,000 a year.
That's a habit. Oh, that'd be fabulous. That'd be fabulous. Everybody needs to, I mean, I love that vocational training.
So do I. Pete, thanks very much. I appreciate the call. Glad to be with you. If you want to jump in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Coming up, we'll talk about energy prices around the country skyrocketing and why. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers, of course, always go to the head of the line, 866-439-5277. You can send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll, @LarsLarsonShow. And join me in welcoming Daniel Turner, the president of Power the Future. Daniel, good to have you back.
It is great to be on your show again. Thanks for having me.
So tell me this. You wrote, and I thought this was a clever way of putting it, when President Biden warned of a bleak and deadly winter, he was referring to the COVID-19 outbreak that he promised to shut down, but he's actually giving us a bleak winter because of increasing energy prices, both natural gas, electricity, diesel, gasoline, just about every kind of energy out there is going through the roof, and the president keeps talking about fixing the problem. But can he actually get anything done about it?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. Even hearing those words about COVID, I remember when he said it was pretty jarring. It's not the tone you want your president to strike when talking about a bleak and dark winter. But he has sat by and watched energy prices escalate on a monthly basis as a direct result of his policies. And he then plays this anonymous and innocent victim as if he has no idea what's happening and has no idea how to stop it. They blame OPEC. They blame the supply chain. They blame every other, they blame COVID, but they don't ever look inward and say our policies have caused this.
I guess anybody who actually frames the question the way you did, Daniel, risks being called a dumb SOB by Joe Biden. If he actually says, Mr. President, haven't you created the very problem? How can you fix it if you're the one who's actually making it happen? But I've had some people, Daniel, and I want you to back me up on this. Well, if you feel like it, who've said, you can't blame this on Joe Biden. And I said, yeah, I think we can. But give him the chapter and verse on why this is coming directly out of policies that Joe Biden started on his first day in office.
Yeah, this is all the accumulation of multiple policies that have really made the production of oil and gas very, very difficult in our country. And we are a supply-side economy, right? Our economy requires there to be productivity and supply of said good. By making the supply very, very limited, and we are producing 2 million, almost 3 million barrels of oil fewer per day than we were just 14 months ago, by making the supply very limited, he's driven up the prices. So this is a direct consequence of his policy. He made the supply hard to come by. He made oil and gas production difficult because he wanted to appease the green movement. He wanted to tell them, oil and gas have no place in my administration or my America, so he made it hard for them to do their job. This is just a logical consequence that many of us who know the way the world works could have easily predicted.
You know, I got to tell you, Daniel, my personal side of this, my stepson worked in the oil fields in North Dakota about 6 years ago. And guess why his job largely went away? Because oil prices had dropped into the 30s. Some of that was the economy, but some of it was just we were producing so much of it. And I'm with you. When America says we want X, whatever X happens to be, frozen yogurt, barrels of oil, you know, automobiles, the people who supply those things say, hey, people are paying a lot of money for this. Let's make more of it. So the argument was, well, oil drilling has gone down or new exploration has gone down 5-6 years ago because the price has dropped so low. But now the price is right back where we used to see every time the prices got 60, 70, 80 bucks a barrel, there were people out looking for it. But as you say, what's the one thing that we could point to and say, this is why something that's in high demand that people are paying a lot of money is not being supplied? And the only real reason, I mean, if you were trying to make the other side's argument, this isn't Joe's fault. Is there anything you could point to that retards the supply of oil other than these federal policies that Biden pushed?
Well, yes, and that is the investment in this industry. And so, as you were saying, we used to see gas, oil at this price, and investors would jump in and say, wow, there's money to be made. And then when too much investment jumps in and we produce too much oil, the price plummets. But that's not going to happen necessarily this time because there's a huge movement supported by the Biden administration to scare off investors. Investment is down almost 30% in this space. And why? Well, just a couple hours ago, as I was preparing to come on the show with you, I saw the House Subcommittee on Climate Change issue subpoenas to the board members of many of the nation's oil and gas industries. If I'm a board member, I don't want to go be hauled before Congress. I don't want discovery going through all of my emails and my finances. Why? Because they hate this industry, and they're going to make you regret being a board member for ExxonMobil or for Chevron. And it's the same with all other investors. Why would I invest in this industry if I know the Secretary of the Interior, the Secretary of Energy are going to either persecute me, they're going to sic Greta Thunberg and her activists at my house? I'm not going to invest in this industry. I'll invest in something else. And then on the other hand, they reward the industries they like, wind, solar, et cetera, with huge corporate, huge government subsidies. So oil is here to stay, sadly, for the immediate future.
Well, and you've got the oil companies being set upon by the government. But do you know the other one I saw, Daniel, is I knew I was getting ready to talk to you today. Politico ran this story out. I'll just read you the first line because you can imagine the rest. This is from Politico.com. The nation's top financial regulators will soon embark on a controversial first-of-its-kind mission, forcing banks and other industry players to prepare for potential threats to the U.S. financial system from climate change. So in other words, they're going to go to all the people that finance providing oil and say, we don't want you doing that anymore. And they say they're doing it in the name of saving the planet from climate change.
And and the Federal Reserve will mark as risky, I predict this, they will mark as risky investments in this space. And then if you have a risky investment on your balance sheet, well, then the Fed, I mean, this is one of the roles of the Feds. Well, they will judge you differently. Do I want risky investments on my balance sheet? Well, no, I'm not going to invest in this space. And this is pure government activism trying to destroy an industry. And we have to still live in this world where right now on the East Coast, we are going on several weeks of below freezing weather. And in a couple of months, we'll have several weeks of above 90 degree weather and we want air conditioning, right? It's the industry that heats and fuels and powers our whole economy, and we're allowing government to destroy it. And in the consequence, people are going to suffer tremendously. And that's the real evil behind this.
I mean, they literally said they're going to, among other moves, regulators will press the banks to prepare for fallout from a warming planet by stepping up scrutiny. Like you said, when they go to an industry, say, you guys are risky. Why? Because Joe Biden says you are. So therefore, we're going to charge you a few more basis points or a few more percentage points on your loans. And you say, hold on, you're going to price us out of taking the loans out that make it possible for us to do what we're doing. And the banks are going to say, that's right. That's what Joe wants. Joe wants the oil industry shut down. He'll choke off your money supply.
And then in the process, everything that requires petrochemicals, which is fertilizer and pesticides and our agriculture industry, all these prices are going to go through the roof. And then when the president is asked, he'll either call you an SOB or he'll blame supply chain or he'll blame some other issue. But they've had investigations into big agriculture because they think they're colluding to raise prices. Nope. Prices are expensive because energy is expensive, and Joe Biden made that happen.
Yeah, sadly so. Daniel, thanks so much. We appreciate you coming on the show.
Always a pleasure, Lars. Thank you.
That is Daniel Turner from Power of the Future. He's the president of the group. And I'd be glad to take a naysayer on this. Anybody wants to tell me that Joe Biden is not driving this war on energy? And if you're not worried about that, you haven't pulled up at the pump recently and put a $100 bill into your gas tank, because that's happening to people too. And just remember, even if you're one of those greenies, say, I ride a bicycle. How do you think that bicycle got to the store where you bought it? How do you think the food got to the store where you bought it? How do you think every single thing you own got to the store where you bought it? It came on a truck or a train or a boat. And Joe Biden is making the fuel for all of those much more expensive. Back in just a moment. 866-HEY-LARS. Send your emails talk@LarsLarson.com. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. This segment of the show brought to you by Marquee Hot Tubs. They'll give you the ultimate hot tub and swim spa experience. Just visit them online or go to one of their three locations, MarqueeHotTubs.com. Our Twitter poll today, should all electric customers pay to fund car chargers for a tiny, usually wealthy minority of electric car owners? I said no to that. Just in case you think that's only a rhetorical question, it's already state law. House Bill 2165, passed last year in the state of Oregon, that requires utilities to collect a charge every single month from your electric bill. Whether you own an electric car or not, and most people do not own an electric car, I think Kate Brown had set a goal of getting to 250,000 electric cars out of about 3 or 4 million cars in the state. She'd set that goal. She's nowhere near it. They're at about 50,000 electric cars right now. They are still a relatively rare item. To your calls now. Let's go to Jason. Hey, Jason, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to talk about the 18, 19, 20-year-old potential drivers that might be able to hit the highways. And I believe that it could be a great idea. And I want to talk about when I first started driving 27 years ago, it was a lot different. Trucks were a lot different. You had to know how to shift, downshift, hit the right gear to go down a grade, and, you know, your Jake brake may or may not work, right? Well,
right.
These new trucks today, they're automatics. Most of these, all the big trucking outfits are all coming out with automatics. They've been using automatics now for, I'd say, at least 15 years.
And yep.
I'm not saying that, once again, I'm not saying that it doesn't mean that a young person still needs to learn how to drive the vehicle. But this helps a lot with, you know, it knows what gear it needs to go down the hill. It doesn't allow you to go over speed. Your exhaust brake helps you down the hill. If you could become too close to somebody, it will hit the brakes. You know, it will let you know if you're going over and there's somebody there. All these outfits are paying for this stuff, and most of it comes standard in these big rigs for insurance purposes and safety of others. So there's just a lot of great things that will help these new drivers navigate the road today and make it safe for everybody. And I just want people to think about that. There's even more things where you can't set your cruise control if it's raining. If you're using your windshield wipers, you can't set your cruise control for hydroplane possible purposes. You know what I mean? So it's just
Those are great cutouts. And Jason, I'm in favor of the idea. I always tell people, whether I like an idea or not, very rarely do I run into one where I'm sort of ambivalent 50-50. But on this one, when I saw that, I thought, you get the right young man or woman at 18, 19, or 20 who says, I want to drive a big rig. Okay, great. You got to get the CDL. You got to get a company that will trust you. And as you said, I know it's going to take a while for the older rigs to work their way out of the system. But as you said, the ones that are buying, the newer ones, are buying trucks that take a lot of the, you know, those things away and say, we're not going to let you get in trouble. Now, does that make it bulletproof? No, it doesn't. But it certainly eliminates a lot of things that would have caused a problem before. Probably even lane-keeping devices like they're putting in passenger cars now, where it starts to really, light you up if you're starting to drift out of your lane, which is a problem.
It honks the horn. You can hear it. It'll honk the horn and let you know inside, and you'll be able to hear the horn honk as well. And these companies also have cameras facing you and facing out, and they'll actually, if you're driving unprofessionally or not safe, they will send something over the radio and say, you need to pull over immediately. You know, you might not be driving that truck again for a while. You know what I mean? So they're really watching it at every angle to watch out for everybody on the road as well as the person driving the rig. They're really trying pretty hard, and I think that they deserve a chance. You know, because I'm working 7 days a week.
What kind of surprises me, Jason, is that you're an enthusiast about this, and you've been driving for 27 years. I more commonly hear people who are old school drivers say, I don't like that stuff. And I say, well, but if it works. I mean, when they first came out with ABS brakes in passenger cars, I loved trying it out. I got up into an empty parking lot that was covered with ice, and it got going 10, 15 miles an hour, slammed on the brakes, said, oh, that's interesting. Get up to 30 miles an hour, slam on the brakes. And you say, oh, this could really help you. Because, skill can get you out of that, too, by really knowing how to work the brakes. But since most people don't run into those conditions, but very often, it's nice to have the ABS to back you up. And all of them are going to have some fans like you and some people who say, no, I don't like that stuff. I want it all to be manual. I get that. But it could save you, in certain circumstances where the truck knows some things that you don't know.
Correct. Well, I'll tell you, we're delivering to customers 30, 40, 50 days late, and I work for a huge trucking outfit, and if we don't get this solved, all this is infecting all of us, and we need some help, and we've got bodies out there if they'd like to do it. We're training people and paying you to be trained and full medical, and there's all kinds of perks out there. And it'd be nice to have some relief so I can have time with my family as well as these other guys that are being forced to work 6 and 7 days a week. I'm a union shop. I know you're not a fan of a union, but
that's all right.
Kind of forced you, So,
But tell me, Jason, when you show up with cargo that's 40 or 50 days late, what's the response from your customer?
Well, I can't say it on the radio. They're not very happy and decide they want to go somewhere else. But the problem is you can go anywhere else. But I could name a bunch of outfits. I work for Yellow Freight. I'll just say it. But there's all kinds of freight. We're all in the same boat. It's bad out there. We've got 200 trailers in our yard that we haven't even touched.
Unbelievable.
We're just in Portland, and Yellow is, it's a huge company, so it's not just our terminal this way.
I was going to say name the company, Jason, because when people hear that, they inevitably say to me, how do I get a hold of that company? I want to go into that line of work as well. I'm glad to mention it. Yellow Freight. Jason.